Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Nozir Daf Samach Dalid. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage, and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins 7 lines from the top of Daf Samach Dalet. On the side of the Gemara, you will notice a nosei, a topic heading. Before we read our topic heading, let us point out we're continuing the topic of Tuma Tzofa. We discussed this in our previous year, that if there is a situation of a sheretz that is floating on water, and someone has a doubt as to whether they came into contact with it, we saw a machlokas tanoim, but suffice it to say that even though there's a principle of sofek tuma b'rishus hayochid, when there's a doubt concerning tuma, we are machmir. If you're dealing with tuma tzofa, with something floating, so based on gzeres hakosev, there's a special leniency. There's a machlokas rishonim that the gra makes an allusion to on our daf in Os Beis that holds that the concept of Tuma Tzofa, according to the Rambam, is limited only to Shrotzim, not to other forms of Tuma when they are floating and there is a doubt of having had contact with them. That having been said, we say that's the Shitas HaRambam. Other Rishonim expand the concept of Tuma Tzofa to all situations of Tuma, whatever the source of the Tuma is, if the Sofek is a Sofek, a doubt, as having had contact with it, Tumas Maga. We're going to see in our Sukya that we're not going to apply a Sofek to a case of Tuma Tzofa to something that would be metame ba'oihel, only if the sofek is be'mago, contact. So now our note on the side reads as follows. Hakula shel tuma tzofa, shayich rak be'mikrim shel sofek mago. As we mentioned, the leniency concerning floating tuma applies only when the matter of doubt is, was there physical direct contact with the item, the source of the tuma. Another point we will see, dovar hanizrak, something that is thrown, it's in flight. The noitzar sofek mago, and an issue of doubt concerning contact with the item while it was in flight. Gam ke nechshav ke mikre shel tuma tzofa. It is also considered like Tuma Tzofa. In other words, Tzofa, which means floating, doesn't mean only floating on the water. You see from here that the concept is Tuma that's not stationary on the ground. Now, when we said stationary on the ground, let us mention ahead of time that that's not the only situation where a sofek of Tumas Maga will present itself as a sofek. What are exactly the guidelines of what is tzofa and what is not tzofa? So we'll see examples in our Gemara through which one can then develop a set of guidelines. So now the Gemara, 7 lines from the top. We open with a Tanaic, source Tonu Rabbonan. Kol hanitlin v'hanigrorin. Items that are moved or dragged, and while they're in movement, there is a doubt as to having had contact with something tohor. Could be taharos, food that needs to maintain purity, or a person. The source of tumah, notice, it's not stationary. It's being carried or dragged by a person. Could be that the source of tumah is attached to a rope or a string, and it's being dragged along, and it might have come into contact with someone standing nearby, or someone was carrying the tumah. So notice, it's not stationary, but its locomotion is based on the fact that a person is moving it. So the source tells us sfeik on tome mitnei shein kemunachim, the sfeik of having had contact will lead us to rule tumah. There is defilement because halachically they are considered stationary. They're not considered floating. And why is that? As we said, because a person is the one that has control over it. This expression you can see in the Tosfos on the second Tosfos from the top. The second to last line of that Tosfos says, "Kevon shiyad adam tofes ba ein kan din tumat safa." Since a person is in control of it, is holding onto it, though the item is in movement, it does not have the status of tuma safa, of floating tuma. We continue in the source, v'hanizrokin, an item that's not in control by the human being. It's true, it was projected by the human being, it was thrown, it was cast by the human being, and is in flight. And while in flight, it might have touched something. Sfeikon tohar. The doubt will be ruled leniently that no tumah. Chutz min kezayis hames v'hamahil al pnei tumah, with the exception of an olive quantity of corpse flesh, or that was thrown. Now, corpse flesh, if you have an olive quantity of it, it will create tumah even without contact, simply by the fact that it passes over something else that is subject to tumah. Tumah will be imposed. And v'amahil al pnei tumah, or some taharos, something that needs to remain tohor, was thrown, was cast over a source of tumas meis. V'chol davar shemetama milamala kilamata, and all other things that create tuma from above and from below without direct contact. There are other forms of tuma that have that capacity. Lasuye, and this comes to include the case of zav v'zava. A zav and zava, these are, zav is a male, a zava female, that have respective emissions that create tumah. They become, these people become tomei, and if they were to, let us say, sit on a boulder that's positioned over a pit in the ground, and in the pit there are articles of clothing, let's say. Those articles of clothing become tome. That is called tuma of even misama. We're not going to spend time dealing with that, but one should simply realize that that's a case of tuma that's communicated, that's transferred without actual contact between the zav and the clothing. So if there's a suffix concerning those types of tuma, we're going to rule tome. They do not have they're not categorized as tuma tsafa. We now start a question. Now you'll notice we have a long question marking. And in this long question, notice our marked page is quite marked. There are numbers. You see numbers running down the right-hand side of the Gemara text, numbers 1 through 7. Take note of the fact that 1 through 4 are circled and the last 3 have diamonds around them. There's a reason for that. On the other side of on the margin of the Gemara, we have under our nosei, our topic heading, We've written Sidra Shel She'elois, a series of questions, Be'inyin Tuma Tzafa, in this topic of the floating Tuma. And the Mivneh, the structural note, highlights a double underline, which you'll see features the expression Im Tim Salomar. It's an abbreviated expression. You know, the question format presents initially a question with two sides to it, and then the Gemara presents a second question. if you assume one approach, then I will present another question, and you see the Mahu word is dashed, underlined. At that point, the second question is stated. And this is a repeating structure. Each time, questions, new questions built upon the previous questions, are presented, each one with two sides to it. When you get to number five, the reason that there's a change in the style of numbering, of marking, it's because these questions are not built upon the first four questions. But all told, we have, it appears as seven questions that have some connection to this topic of Tuma Tzafa, the Gemara. I don't know if I should spoil the fun ahead of time, but you'll notice that at the end of the long question, there's no answer. It ends off with a teku. The questions remain unresolved. But nevertheless, boy, Romi, Barchamo. Now, we're making girsa changes here based on the Gros emendations. The Rashi, and I believe the Tosfos, have a different approach. We're going to follow the Gros in the Gemara, but having said that, the Gros approach is that the Din of Tuma Tzofa is Sheretz related, and that's based on the Rambam. It's only Sheretz related. Therefore, the questions focus on Sheretz. The Gemara text itself, without his changes, make reference to other forms of Tuma, specifically mace, corpse material in a Tuma Tzofa scenario. But we're going to follow, in our reading, we're going to follow the Gros. That's the convention that we chose here. So now the Gemara, boy, Rami Bar Chama, Sheretz. Notice that's a change already in our mark, in our emendations, based on the Gros. Sheretz Bekli, a dead Sheretz is in a vessel. Kli Tzof Al Panei Hamayim, and the vessel is floating on water. And of course, there's a doubt. Did I have contact with the Sheretz? Mahu, is this a case of Tuma Tzofa? Bosar Kli Azlinan, do I focus on the vessel? If I focus on the vessel, so then the Sheretz is, in a sense, is in effect lying still in the vessel. It's not floating. It's lying flat on the bottom of the vessel. So it's like it's on the ground, and if there's a doubt concerning mago contact, we would rule tome. Oi bosar maya azlinon. Or do we look at the broader picture and say, well, this whole entity is on water, so it is floating, and the sofek mago doubt concerning contact with it would result in a ruling of leniency. In timtzilomar bosar kli azlinon. If you take the approach, and again, it doesn't mean you have to take this approach, but the Gemara poses it as choosing one of the two sides. If you take the approach that will focus on the kli, on the vessel, and then that would mean we'll rule stringently in the case of doubt. Sheretz al gabi mace mahu. Let us say you have the piece of sheretz that's sitting upon a piece of on a corpse that's floating on water, or on a piece of corpse material floating on water. And the doubt is with regard to, did I have contact with that sheretz? Mahu. Kevon, and again, we're working with the assumption in the previous question that the sheretz lying on the vessel is considered on the ground, it's considered stationary. What about in this case? Kevon, dahai tumas erev, ahai tumas shiva. Since the duration of the tumah that each one of these items generates is different, The sheretz is a tumas erev, means a person who becomes defiled because of contact with the sheretz, he remains defiled till sundown. The contact with the mace would result in a 7-day defilement period. So the mace, which is the base of this sheretz, upon which the sheretz is lying, is very different. So keman demachta tuma bekli damyo, it's viewed in our eyes as if the sheretz is in a vessel, and we would rule tuma. Again, the doubt here is with regard to, did I have contact with the sheretz? Oy dilma tuma smichtahi, or do we say, no, it's one continuum of tuma. It's not like the vessel. The vessel itself doesn't have inherent defilement. Here you have two pieces that are one continuum of inherent defilement. Tuma smicha means thick tuma, one thick piece. And therefore, it would be viewed as tzof, as floating. V'imtim tzeloma keman demachto tuma bekli damyo. And again, we take, in this third stage, the stringent approach. And if you say that we're going to view that case as well as if the sheretz, while lying on the mace, is lying on a vessel. Question 3. Sheretz agabi nevela v'nevela tzofa ma'u. Let's say you have a piece of sheretz lying on unslaughtered animal meat. Nevela is animal meat that was not slaughtered properly. A dead cow that's floating on the water. And I want to ask, what is the status of the sheretz in this case when a doubt concerns, did I have contact with it? Kevon de travayo tumas erev inun tumas michtehi. Since both have the same tuma duration, one evening, up 1 day tuma. So it's considered like one continuum, one thick continuum of tuma, and it would be considered like floating. And the doubt would result in leniency. Oy dilma. Or we are to emphasize a different aspect of things, and that tumas nevela hai kezayas. Nevela is metame, communicates tum if you have an olive quantity of it, and vahai keadosha. And sheretz communicates tuma if you have even a much smaller amount, an adosha quantity. Adosha is sometimes translated as a lentil bean amount, but it's smaller than an olive quantity. And therefore, since they have this difference, the sheretz is considered like on a vessel. And again, we would rule stringently in a case of doubt concerning contact. Sheretz al gabi sheretz ma. What about this case where you have a sheretz lying upon another sheretz? Hani vadai chad shiuroninu. Well, these seem to be certainly the same quantity, the same duration, the same amount, so it'd be floating. Oh, dilma kevan de mifsiki mehadadi lo. On the other hand, since they're two separate pieces, mifsiki means they're separate from one another. It's true one is lying on the other, but they're separate things. So the upper one is not considered floating. It's lying stationary on the lower one. Again, following the gra, we are taking out from our reading the next two lines, and we start question number 5. Sheretz al gabi nevela shini mucha mahu. You have a piece of sheretz that's lying or floating on some dissolved or melted nevela. What is the din? Kevon de nemucha haviole mashke. Since the nevela, what was once meat, is now slimy, it's melted, it's considered a liquid, and the sheretz that's floating on this, in this nevela slime, is considered tumatsofa, and the doubt concerning contact with the sheretz under these circumstances would result in leniency, tahara. Oy dilma, hai uchla hu. Or do we say that the slime essentially comes from food, and it's not considered floating, it's considered on the ground. The imtim salomar de uchlahu, and if you take that approach, that, well, its origin, the nevela, is food, sheretz al gabi shichvas zera mahu. Let us say I have sheretz that's floating on shichvas. Shichvas zera is semen, male semen. We've been learning along with the Rambam, but I just want to point out that Rashi, regarding this, says that the shichvas zera itself is floating on water. So that you have a piece of sheretz lying in a puddle of shichvas zera. Now, shichvas zera, the semen, is a thicker substance, so it will end up being, it's thick. It itself is floating on the water. So the question now is, the sheretz, how are we to view it? Rashi presents the possibilities, and if we look in the Rashi, four lines from the bottom, sheretz sof al gabi shichva zera, the shichva zera tsof al pnei amayim mahu, mi amrinon hoyo v'shichva zera lav uchlohu. Since shichva zera is not food, it's not food, it's not parallel to the nevela that melted. Havilei kemashke, v'avisheretz tsof usfeiko tohor. There is another side, though, of the analysis, which the Gemara doesn't spell out, but it spells it out in its continuation of the question with the imtim tzolomar. If you go back to the Gemara text, you'll see the second side of the analysis here. Vimtim tzolomar kevon demis akro havilei ki uchlo. Since the shichva zera comes from the human being, but it's not like, let us say, other liquids in a human being that assemble in an organ and then emerge, but rather it comes from the human flesh itself. That's the best I can do for right now. You can look into the Rashi, how he describes it, but the fact that the shichva zera and its origin and emission is different than other body fluids, the Gemara says, kiva de misakra. Misakra literally means it's uprooted from the body, from the flesh of the person. Have le ki uchla. It is like food. And the sheretz that's sitting on top of the shichva zera would be considered stationary. That leads us into the seventh question. Sheretz agabi mei chatos, o mei chatos sofen agabi hamayim mahu. Let's say you had a piece of sheretz floating on the red heifer ash water mixture. Now that water is thick because it's mixed with the ash of the red heifer, of the paraduma. And that paraduma water is itself on top of regular water. On top of that, as we said, there is sheretz. Mahu, what is the din in that case? Lo yad inon. We don't have an answer. Teku, it remains unresolved. We continue now at the top of Omid Beis. Before we continue with the Gemara text, we glance at the side where we have a Nosei topic heading. Nozir v'oisa Pesach show you Tamei Meis. A Nozir, or someone on his way to do the Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan. These people had been Tamei Meis. V'higiu le'zayin shalahem, and they reached the seventh day of Tumas Meis, that's the day of final day of the purification week. Ubo bayom, on that Yom HaZayin, holchu bekever hatahom. Here we're going back to a topic that we had discussed in our previous year at great length, the topic of the unknown tuma, namely at the point of, we'll say, contact with it or overshadowing of it. It was not known to anybody. Subsequently, it was revealed, and in our case, it was revealed that on that day that he was doing the seventh day of his purification week, they had walked over an unknown grave, either the Nozir or the Osa Pesach. And once again, the Nozir we're talking about is a Nazir who had been Tomei Meis, and he was observing a week of cleanness, of purification. And on that seventh day, they encountered the Tumas HaTahom. And we're meeting the Nazir and the Osa Pesach a while later. In the case of the Nazir, for example, we're meeting him after he completes his Nazirus. What happens now? Did that encounter with the Tumas Tahom affect him and make him count all over again? Let's see how the Gemara deals with this. Omar Rav Hamnuna, Nazir v'Osa Pesach, Shaholchu b'kever ha-tahom b'shvi shalahem. Tahorim, they are ruled to be unaffected. My taima, why are they unaffected? The lo alima tumas ha-tahom lemistar. Tumas ha-tahom is not alima. Alima means strong enough. It's not potent enough, a form of defilement, to undo what they have done. Let us look at the Rashi together. Rashi on the top. Omar Rav Hamnuna, Nozir Osa Pesach, Shinitmu B'Tumas Meis, Vehuza Lan B'Shlishiu B'Shvi, and they were observing their week of purification involving the sprinkling of the red heifer ash water mixture on them on the third and seventh days of that week. Veholchu B'Kevar Tom B'Shvi Shalahen, and they walked over an unknown grave. And we say unknown means at the time that they walked over it, it was unknown. It became known later on, but at that time it was unknown. On their seventh day, and it did not become revealed to the fellow doing the Pesach until he sacrificed his Korban Pesach. As far as the Nazir is concerned, it became revealed to him after he finished observing his 30 days of Nazirus taking the haircut, namely 30 days later. The Rashi continues to Horim. V'afagav dinitmu b'shvi shalahen, even though they encountered Tuma on their seventh day of their purification days, delo alima tumas tum lemistar, tumas tum is not strong enough to undo what they had accomplished. We continue. Mosiv Rava. Yorad Litoher Mitumas Meis. A person who descended into a mikveh to purify himself from death defilement. And there was discovered, it doesn't say in the words of the source, but Rashi points out the explanation, there was discovered later on some corpse or corpse flesh sunk into the floor of this cave, the cave in which he went for his immersion. There was a mikveh in the cave. It was discovered that there was some mace sunk into the ground of that cave. So the source tells us that he is Tomei. Why? Shecheskas Tomei. Someone who had been defiled, had the status of defilement, remains in that state. You see, we're not taking someone that is tohor and defiling him. He's a person that was in a state of defilement. And since he was already in that, we'll say that weakened state of being defiled, he cannot enjoy the benefits of Tumas HaTahom. Likewise, if the person had been went into that mikveh and he had been tohor, he went in, let's say, just to cool off, he wasn't tomei, then he would remain tohor, shecheskas tohor. Now, what we have to focus on, though, is the statement in this source that for someone who had the status of tumah, who was seeking purification but was not yet there, the encounter with the Tumas HaTahom prevents him from reaching purification at that point. That having been said, our case above, the Nozir and the Yosef Pesach, on their seventh day, they had not been Tohor yet. They were on their seventh day. They don't become Tohor until sundown. The Nozir on the seventh day had, as we said, he had the red heifer water sprinklings on the third and the seventh day, but on that seventh day, and we can see this in the Rashi explanation, he encountered the Kever Tahom before he took his haircut. So he hadn't, let's assume that he hadn't taken his haircut and the sun had not set. The haircut is after the mikveh that he must do on that seventh day. So they are still Tomei. How can Rav Hamnuna say then that the Kever HaTom does not affect them and they can enjoy what they thought to be Tahara, when their contact with the Tumas HaTom was at a point that they had not yet reached the status of Tahara? Omar Lay. So Rav Hamnuna responds, Modina Loch Benozir Shemechusur Tiglachas. I will concede to you that the Nozir is Tomei. Since his contact with the Tumas HaTahom on the seventh day of his purification week was before the haircut, he is considered defiled by that contact with the Tumas HaTahom. Even though he discovered this, we'll say, unfortunate story a month later, after he observed his, what he thought was his Nazirus de Tahara, his Nazirus impurity. Let's emphasize the point again. The Gemara says, Shemechusur Tiglachas. He's missing an essential aspect of Nazir purification, the haircut that a Nazir takes at the end of the week of the clean week after defilement. So he hadn't yet done that, so he didn't really achieve Tahara. And therefore, the Tumas HaTom will have its defiling effect. And therefore, the Nazirus that he thought he was observing for that subsequent month doesn't count, because he didn't ever really become Tohor in order to start his Nazirus all over again. Omar Le Rava. Now, Rava, who had raised the opposition to Rav Hamnuna, here Rava says, Af ano modina loch ba'oise pesach. I will concede to you that there is Tahara for the Oise Pesach. What's the case of the Oise Pesach? The 14th of Nisan represented represents the day on which we have to process a Korban Pesach. And on his, he had been, this Oise Pesach fellow had been Tomei Meis. And on that seventh day of purification, the fellow who thought he was going to be doing his Korban Pesach, he encountered Tumas HaTahom. And at what point did he encounter the Tumas HaTahom? During the seventh day. Let us make the assumption it was the seventh day after he immersed in the mikveh. Did he need to do anything else? No. So Rava says, in the case of the Oise Pesach, in contrast to the Nozir who encountered the Tumas HaTahom before he took that final haircut, here a standard Tomei Meis doesn't have any haircut requirements. He has the Por Aduma water requirements, which he did already. He immersed in the mikveh. let's assume that he immersed in the mikveh. That's already something we might touch on later. Why does Rava concede over here that the Tumas Homa does not affect him? The lo mechusar velo klum, because he's not missing anything. Omer le Abaye v'ho mechusar herav shemesh. Abaye says, but he hasn't had sundown yet. He experienced the Tumas HaTahom on his seventh day. In order to achieve Tara, you need to have, besides everything we've said till now, you have to complete the seventh day with sundown following his mikveh. And he's missing that. Omale, Rava says, Shimsho Meilo Arva. The setting of the sun is not something that human beings have control over. It happens through the force of nature that God created. The Meilo conveys that idea. Literally, it happens on its own. In contrast to the case of the Nozir and his haircut, which is something that a person initiates, had a person-based action not taken place yet, so the person is still viewed becheskas tuma, having the status of tuma, and therefore the tumas atom will have its effect of, let's say, extending the defilement. However, if the only thing that's missing is the setting of the sun, that doesn't bother us. It's not. It's considered as if nothing is missing. It's considered from our perspective that the individual achieved tahara and the tumas atom would not have any effect. So in this give and take, you notice Abaye initially was presenting Herav Shemesh as a missing action necessary for achieving tahara. Rava said, no, it's not considered a missing action because memela arva. V'af Abaye hodarbe. Abaye himself reverses his position to agree that setting of the sun, even though it's a necessary event for achieving absolute purification, it's not considered an action in our context with regard to enabling the Tumas Atom to have an effect. Now, notice with our markings, we have a long point marking. All of this is designed to convey the idea that Abaye Hodarbe, Abaye reversed his position. We'll see this at the end of the very long point, where in response to a question the Gemara raises, in fact, this very point of, isn't he missing Herav Shemesh? We haven't mentioned what the point was, but in the context of the Gemara, Abaye's response is, nah, Herav Shemesh isn't a problem. The setting of the sun doesn't present a lack because Memei La'arva. So that very point that Rava makes now is something that Abaye himself adopts. And that's what we mean that Abaye Hodarbe. The approach that Amir Tzashem we're going to take with regard to this piece of Gemara from the beginning of the long point till the Mishnah will be such that we'll read through the Gemara with little to no explanation, and then learn the Tosfos, the three Tosfosin that we'll learn to serve as explanation of the Gemara. The reason for this is something characteristic of Maseches Nozir, and that the style, the give-and-take style question-answer, is not so, we'll say, obvious as it would be in other Gemaras. Before we begin the text, we glance at the side. We have a Tatnosei. This Tatnosei is a subcategory, a subheading, because we're within the general realm of what constitutes being within a period of Tuma and what constitutes having completed Tuma observance. The Tatnosei, subtopic heading reads as follows, reading in the margin, Isha Sheyolda, a woman who gave birth. And in Halacha, when we speak about giving birth, that includes miscarriages as well. A woman who gives birth or miscarries is obligated to bring a sacrifice. the type of, or the timing of the sacrifice is dependent on the gender of the child. A male birth requires a sacrifice to be brought 41 days after the birth, and a female birth 81 days after the birth. And when you look in the Gemara and the commentaries, you'll see the numbers presented in letter form. Mem Aleph is 41, Pei Aleph is 81. So our the heading reads, the Isha Shealda V'toch Malois Shelei Daharishon Hepila. The term Malos means the completion days. We just gave an example of that. Female birth generates an 81-day period. During the 80 days, the woman is said to be Tomei. It's a low-level Tumah that she has, but she's considered, in halachic terms, a Tvulas Yom Oroch. For our purposes, we're not going to burden ourselves with too many details, otherwise we'll get confused and lose sight of what the goal of our sugya is. So the woman spoken of here had a birth, let's say a female birth, and within those 81 days, in the middle of the time, on day 64, she had a miscarriage. V'toch malos shalei d'shnia, and then within 81 days of that miscarriage, aval achar malos shel rishona, hipilo shlishis. There was a third miscarriage that took place within 81 days of that second birth, but the third birth was more than 81 days since the first birth. So you have this type of, if you want to use imagery, of time and physicality. Imagine a chain link, where you have a chain made of links, and the second link is interconnected with the first link, and the third link is interconnected with the second link, but has no contact with the first link. We know, as we said, that korbonos are required upon the birth, but not at the day of the birth, but at day 81, at the completion. We call it at the end of the Malois period. If a second birth takes place within the Malois period of the first birth, so there's no second korban that's generated. It's included in the korban that the first birth required. In fact, the second birth took place at a time when the woman could not have yet brought a sacrifice. She hadn't achieved full purification enabling her to bring the sacrifice. She didn't reach day 81. So the second birth is included within the sacrifice of the first birth. What about the third birth? When the third birth takes place, on the one hand, it's more than 81 days from the first birth. So there's room to think that the third birth will generate its own sacrifice. On the other hand, the third birth takes place at a time that the woman could not yet have brought any sacrifices, because the tumah that's generated by birth was being prolonged, was being extended by these multiple births, third birth being within the malos of the second birth. Let us now turn to the Gemara text after having given this introduction. We mentioned that the point of this Gemara is to demonstrate that Abaye himself does a turnabout to agree with Rava that the setting of the sun is not considered an action per se, and therefore if a person did everything that a person's required to do in order to achieve purification and the only thing that's missing is the setting of the sun, he is considered as having achieved purification. For our purposes, we were speaking about Tumas HaTahom, and we'll extend this idea a little bit more as we go on in the Gemara. So now the Gemara, after saying that Abaye did a turnaround, Disanya, Yoim Melois Tavi, Toich Melois Loi Tavi, a woman who had a miscarriage, a second birth, which was a miscarriage, after a birth, on day 81 of a first birth, she had a second birth, a miscarriage. That's Yom Melos, on day 81 of a female birth. If it was a male birth, it would be day 41, but that gets a little bit complicated with other details that we're not using over here. So the Yom Melos, for our purposes, is day 81 after a female birth. There was a second birth, a miscarriage. So if the second birth, if the miscarriage takes place on day 81, Tavi. Tavi means the mother must bring a second sacrifice, second set of sacrifices that a yoledes, that a childbearing mother, a woman who bore children, must bring. So she has one set of sacrifices for the first birth, and then another set of sacrifices for the miscarriage that took place on day 81. However, if in the middle of those 81 days, meaning let's say on day 64, she has a miscarriage, that's toch malois lo tavi, she doesn't bring a second sacrifice. Eventually, when she achieves purification, when she completes the 81 days from that second birth, she'll bring one sacrifice that will cover both births. Yochol lo tavi al leida shelifnei malois, avol tavi al leida sheleachar malois, v'tiftar mishnehem. Maybe it is so that one korban covers two leidos, two births. When the second birth was within the malos, was lifnei malos, means before the completion of the 81 days of the first birth, so one sacrifice is sufficient. However, if, as we illustrated before in our introduction, she has a third birth that is after day 81 from the first birth, that third birth, however, was within the malos of the second birth. Remember the chain analogy we gave? Could it be that in a case like that, she would bring two sacrifices? Talmud Lomar, Uvim Lois Yemei Tara, B'yom Malos Tavi, Toch Malos Lo Tavi. The only time an additional sacrifice is generated is if the second birth was on the Yom Malos, was on day 81. Or afterwards, of course. But we're focusing right now on that day. It's very important for our illustration that the second sacrifice will be generated by a second birth or a miscarriage on day 81 of the first birth. However, toch malos, births that take place within the malois days of the previous birth, no additional sacrifice is generated. Omar Rav Kahana. Now here, this statement is very, very difficult to translate as it is. When you look into Rashi and you see he says Klomar, meaning that just don't rely on the simple translation. But Rav Kahana is a comment on this source. He, according to Rashi, is coming to explain why toch malois, a second birth toch malois, does not mechayev, doesn't obligate her to bring another korban, whereas on the yom malois that would generate another korban. So Omar Rav Kahana, shiny hocho de mechasra korban. The reason that a leida, a subsequent birth, a second birth within the malos of the first birth, doesn't generate an additional korban is because at the time of that second birth, this woman could not yet have brought her sacrifice for the first birth. So the sacrifice for the first birth eventually is going to include that second birth. So that's Rav Kahana's explanation for the toch malos situation as not generating an additional sacrifice. Why? So we repeat ourselves, because the woman, having given birth to the second child, or the miscarriage, within the malos period, hasn't finished, so to speak, her obligations for the first birth. And what does it mean she hasn't finished her obligations? It means she hasn't brought the sacrifice yet for the first birth. She couldn't have brought the sacrifice. It was toch malos. Ah, but if she has a miscarriage on day 81, then you're telling me she will have to bring a separate sacrifice? The Gemara asks, well, Hossam Nami, there too, in the case of day 81, Mechasra Herav Shemesh. There's a very big discussion, it's quite a bristling discussion between the Meforshim that you see on the page right here in our Gemara. I'm going to present one scenario. I don't want to confuse. We're dealing with very new topics here, and I don't want any information overload to take place. So one approach, you see this in the Rosh, I think you'll see this in the Tosfos also, we're dealing with a case of a woman who gave birth, and she did not go to mikveh as is ordinarily expected on day 14. She didn't go to mikveh on day 14. She delayed her mikveh experience until day 81. So you can have a situation where a woman reaches day 81, she goes to the mikveh then, and in order to achieve purification, she still has to have sundown take place. Why is it that we said that all births, regardless of what the woman did, when a birth takes place on day 81, she has to bring a separate korban? It's like a new time entity. She's left, she's completed her purification obligations regarding the first birth. But she hasn't. If you have a woman that after having given birth, even if it's 81 days ago, but she didn't go to mikveh, she needs to go to mikveh on that day, on day 81. And mikveh itself, mikveh immersion is not sufficient in order to achieve purification. You have to have sundown. Why then is it stated that if there's a second birth on day 81, she has to bring a new sacrifice, a separate sacrifice for that second birth? She's still bound to the first birth. Omar le Abaye Shimsho Memela Arva. The setting of the sun, that's nothing. That happens on its own. It's not considered as if something is lacking. Notice who is saying it? Abaye. It's my feeling at this point that most of the information that we would see in the Tosfos, we've already explained sufficiently in the Gemara, and therefore we won't go through all of the Tosfos in that we thought we would do, but we'll look at the third of the Tosfos in that I wanted to do, Omar Abaye. Or the Tosfos right before that, Hosam Nami Mechusar Herav Shemesh Kemo Vahavinon Ba. The Gemara here, it's Nozir, uses somewhat unusual language, says it Hosam Nami instead of what you would see in other Gemaras. Vahavinon Ba means and we ask. Hosam Beledish Lachar Malois, a birth that takes place on day 81, Amai Tovi Korban Leledish Nia. Why does she bring a sacrifice for the second birth? Homechasar Herav Shemesh. Is she not lacking the setting of the sun? Are we not in fact talking about a woman that did not do the expected mikveh immersion after a mere 2 weeks? She delayed. She waited till now, till day 81. Hare af la'achar shmoinim ein aruya lo havi korban leida rishona. Since she didn't go to mikveh yet on that day 81, and when she goes to mikveh, she still has to wait for the sunset. She's not fit for bringing sacrifices. She'll have to wait till the next day. Vafilu hachi mevia korban al leida shlacha lamos. And even so, she's going to bring a separate sacrifice. Even though, once again, we're repeating, even though she hasn't reached a point in time where she could have brought a sacrifice for the first birth. And yet, we say she brings a separate sacrifice. Omar Abaye, Shim Shomeil Arva Klomar, Lo Mi Baya Chisoron HaTfila, She'eno Choshev Chisoron. And here is a point that we did not emphasize before. We might have even been a little misleading before. We've reached day 81. The woman had not yet gone to mikveh. You know what? We're on day 81, and she miscarries even before going to mikveh. So Tosfos says, Lo mi bay chisoron hatvila she'eno choshev chisoron shem mikveh lefon of yodel litbol. The lack of immersion is, that's not really a lacking. Why? Because it's the mikveh is in front of her. It's something in her power to do, and therefore the miscarriage on day 81. Whether it takes place before the mikveh immersion or after the mikveh immersion, we tell you she has to bring a separate korban. So, as far as the lack of mikveh immersion, that's not a lacking. Elo af harav shemesh she'eino biyado, even the setting of the sun, which is not something you have control over, lo kachoshiv chisaron, it's not considered a lacking. It's considered in our mind's eye as if it already took place. The shimsha Memela Arva, the sun sets on its own through the laws that of nature that God created. So at this point you see that Abaye himself adopted what Rava said earlier, that Shimsha Memela Arva and all that it implied earlier. We now have a new Mishnah, the Nosei, the topic heading, Hamotze Meis, V'achakach Old Mace, person finds a corpse, and then finds another corpse. Mosai nikba dahavi shchunas kvoros v'konu mekoman. This is a new concept. Those of you who learn Maseches Bava Basra might recall that if you find three bodies that are lying next to one another in a space of between 4 and 8 amos, those bodies must remain where they are. You cannot transfer the corpse because those bodies represent to us that which might have been years and years before a formal cemetery. The cemetery discussed in our Mishnah, our Gemara, is a cemetery that essentially is a connection of caves that are joined together by a common courtyard that are dug into the ground. It's subterranean, and the bodies that you found represented three bodies that, being the dimensions are, as we said, between 4 and 8 amos, bodies that would have been buried in crypts that are dug into the walls of a cave, of a burial cave. That is what's called Shchunas Kvoros that we just mentioned. That's by way of very general introduction. Let's turn to the Mishnah. Hamotze Meis Mushkov Kedarko Notlo V'es Tfusoso. If a person finds a body that's lying in a normal burial fashion, normal direction, the Gemara will be analyzing each one of these words, what they come to, let's say, exclude. For the meantime, we can get by with a translation, and one finds a body lying in the ground. Not lo ves fusosa means you take the body and the surrounding earth The Gemara itself will deal with how much earth will you be taking with the body, but that's what fusasa means, the ground that is connected or grabbed up together with the body. Now, you're probably wondering, what are we talking about? Moving bodies, can't the guy be left there to rest in peace? So, let's take a look at Tosfos. Note low, Rashi, the Tosfos we're looking at is in the lower part of the page. Note low, Nihi de kever hayodua minon beperek nigmar din. Granted that a known grave, as is taught in Masechah Sanhedrin, in that perek called nigmar din, osur lefanos, you can't move graves. You can't move bodies from there where they're buried. That's a case where you knew the person was buried there deliberately to remain there. That's avol benimtza, where you happen to chance upon a body. Amrinon hosom muter litlo. We say there that you're allowed to take it to transfer its location. Me'achar shelo noda hakever livnei odom. It was a body found, and it wasn't a known grave to other people. Nochon lomar kilakroi nikbar sham. It's therefore within the realm of reason for us to say it was buried there. Lakroi means like by happenstance, maybe you could say temporarily, and not buried there for the purpose of remaining specifically there. So in the absence of, we'll say, positive knowledge that it was buried there with the purpose of remaining there, you have a right to move it. Move it to, of course, to a proper cemetery. The Mishnah continues. Shnayim, if you found two bodies, note one, v'es tfusasa. Motsa shlosha, if you found three bodies, im yesh bein zeh lo zeh midalet amas at shmoina, harezu shchinas kforos. If you found three bodies lying side by side next to each other, with little gaps between them, we're not talking about bodies found in a mass grave. We're talking about three bodies buried next to each other in a separate fashion within a space of between 4 and 8 amos. Harezu shchunas kforos, that constitutes what we will call, loosely translated, a graveyard, a proper cemetery. And what does that mean? You can't move them. After finding the three bodies, we explained in our introduction that the three bodies may have been buried in one of the walls of a cave. Right now, because of soil erosion and other geological conditions, it doesn't appear anymore as a cave, so that everything looks different. But in your mind's eye, you have to imagine that these three bodies you found were actually buried. There actually had been either a side wall or a back wall of a cave. And these caves had very specific dimensions. We might make reference to them shortly. In Maseches Bava Basra, the sugi appears in a much more elaborate fashion. So having found the three bodies, we suspect that, as we said, it's part of a burial cave. And if you look at we continue at the top of Daf Samach Heomet Aleph, we have an illustration. This is a partial illustration. First of all, it's a bird's eye view. You're looking from top down. What you're looking at in the illustration you see on the top corner essentially is really underground. So there's a chotzer, like an open air chotzer, literally is a courtyard, a little courtyard, a little open area, but it's beneath ground surface. It's open air, though. And from there are entrances into Me'oros. Me'oros are burial caves. The illustration that you see here could have been more elaborate, but where, if you want to see more information, you can look at the reference to the Gemara Bava Basra. But for our purposes, this will suffice, just to give you a feeling. And we're going to give you numbers also. The numbers are presented here superficially. The length of the Me'orah is assumed to be 8 Amos. The Chotzer is measured 6 by 6 Amos, so it has a length of 6 Amos. And the opposite cave also has a length of 8 Amos. So if you find three bodies, they might be the far wall of one of the caves. So now you're going to have to check. Now the Mishnah says, let's read the top line of the Mishnah. Boide kemenu lahalon esrim amo. You have to check 20 amos away from there. You have to keep checking for a period of for a distance of 20 amos because you might find more bodies. And now, how do you figure the 20 amos? You don't see that in the illustration. Here, I don't want to get too bogged down with details, but you're going to be starting at that, we'll say, imagining that the three bodies you found were the far wall of one cave. Then you'd be measuring 8 amos in a particular direction, considering that that would be the length of the cave. Another 6 amos, factoring the chotzer, that's 14 amos. There's a balance of 6 amos, and that we don't have illustrated here how you get to the 6 amos, but be that as it may, it's an additional consideration for finding a second cave, an opposite cave of bodies. So the Mishnah tells us that after finding the three bodies, you have to do that checking for a distance of 20 amos. Motzo echod besoif esrim amos. If you find another bird, a body, 20 amos away, bodek heimenu lalon esrim amo. You have to check another 20 amos for more bodies. And now the idea here of finding an isolated body after having found three bodies. How do we treat that isolated body? We leave it there. Shegraglayim ladovar. That means we have, literally, there's grounds for the matter. Grounds for suspicion. Once you found three bodies, that conjures up the possibility that it might be a cave. The next body you find within 20 amos is another body found in what was once part of this burial cave network. And the Mishnah says, she'ilu t'chila motzo, had you found that isolated body before finding the three bodies, what is it then? It's like we saw in the first part of the Mishnah. Not lo ves fusos, you would have taken it together with the surrounding dirt. But since you found this isolated body after having found the three bodies that we imagine as being part of a burial cave, you can't move this fourth body that you found 20 amas away. The Gemara is going to be darshaning the words of the Mishnah. We've underlined them, so if you just read the underlined words, the next two lines, you see the words motzo, meis, mushkov, kadarko. Those are words taken from, quoted from our Mishnah. So what does each word represent? Omer of Yehuda, motzo, prat, lemotsui. We look in the Tosfos, motzo, prat, lemotsui, pirushri, shimhoyo, yodua, lo yehe notlo. If you knew that someone had been buried there, the body that you found was known to have been buried there with intent to remain there, you wouldn't take it. Kenami perk nigmar din kever animso mutu lufanoso kever hayodua osu lufanoso. A kever of grave that you chanced upon wasn't known to be a grave there, that you can remove. And that's what the word motsa means. You chanced upon it. Not motsui, not something that was known to have been there. The next word, we go back to our Gemara, mace. You found a person that died naturally, prat lahorug, to the exclusion of the case of you found a murder victim. If you found a murder victim, then the laws of the Mishnah of taking the body with the surrounding dirt would not apply. The Rashi points out, Meis prat lahorug, shimotso echod meguyod o shloshten meguyodin. If you found a body that was cut into pieces, or that all three were, then Amrinon dohochi yisrami shineregu lishon v'nikburu b'mekoimon shobes ha'kvoros v'lo machzikinon le'kishunas kvoros el notlon ve'ast fusasan. There, we would say that the law of Shchunas Kvoros would not arise, because they must have been buried there temporarily. They were murdered and just left there temporarily, not with the intent of that being a cemetery. We continue in the Gemara, Mushkov Prat Liyoshev. You found a body lying, not a body that was buried in a seated fashion. If you found it, found a body in a seated fashion, then the law of our Mishnah wouldn't apply. An application of this exception would be, imagine you find two bodies normally buried, in a lying position, and a third body in a seated position. We will tell you that the din of Shchunas Kvoros, the law of our Mishnah, does not apply, and that you, in effect, would be able to remove all three bodies. Later, the Gemara will ask, why is this? Kedarkoi? Prat l'sheroshe munach bein yirei chosav, buried in a normal fashion, with the exception of, in other words, excluded from kedarka would be a body with its head between its knees, between its thighs. Toni ula bar chanina, meis shechoser ein lo tfuso velo shchunas kvoros. If you find a body that is missing, it's an incomplete body, it's missing a limb, then when you move it, you don't move it with the surrounding dirt, you don't have to remove the tfusa, and if you find three bodies, one of whom is missing, then the law of Shchunas Kvoros doesn't apply either. The Tosfos mentions Koshe Lahavin Lama V'Shem Halacha L'Moshe Misinai Hu. Some of these laws are difficult to understand why we make these distinctions. Maybe it's all part of an oral tradition from Sinai. The Gemara asks, V'chol hani mai time alo? Why do we say in all of these cases that you will not create a Shchunas Kvoros? We illustrated before, if you find three bodies, but one of them is in a seated position, or one of them is buried with its head between its knees, why does that not constitute a third body for Shchunas Kvoros purposes? Answer, Amrinon, Dilmo Oved Koychovim Hu. We suspect that maybe it's an idol worshiper that was buried there, so that you wouldn't have then a din of three Jewish bodies, creating a law of Shchunas Kvoros of a Jewish cemetery. The Tosfos points out that Jews don't bury their dead in seated positions or in with head between legs position, so that it creates quite a level of suspicion that this is not a Jewish corpse, and therefore the number of bodies that are Jewish that are there are only two, and there would be no restriction then in moving them, because we haven't created the basis for considering a Shchunas Kvoros. There's a framed section, you notice it's a dashed frame, so we noted on the side, Tamlis Geras Mekuvkov, the reason for this being a dashed frame, we don't have an opening expression here indicating that this is a Tanaic source. You would have, in other occasions, you have a word like Tanyo or Tonu Rabbonon. Here you don't have any opening expression. But as we go on in the source, you're going to see, you go on in this section, a story involving Rabbi Yeshevov and Rabbi Akiva, who were from the greatest of the Tanoim. So we can assume this is a section that is associated with, we'll say, Tanaic literature. The Gemara continues. Motzo Shnayim, Rosho Shelzeh Bitzad Margolosov Shelzeh, V'Rosho Shelzeh Bitzad Margolosov Shelzeh. For the explanation that we want to offer for this piece of Gemara, I'm relying in part on the commenter of the Orach Meshor that you find in the back of Shas Gemoras. You found two bodies. Let me suggest you found two bodies, two out of three bodies. We have a crude illustration to go along with this piece of Gemara. It's not a Picasso or a Matisse, but it will do for crude illustration sake, for purposes anyway. The normal way of burial would be, in the case of three bodies that are buried side by side, heads of each one next to each other, and as a result, the feet of each body next to the feet of the neighboring body. In our case, there were three bodies, but two of them were found head next to feet and feet next to head. And that's what this opening line means. Motza, read again. Motza Shnayim found two bodies. And I'm saying two of the three bodies. Roisha Shelzeh Betzad Margloisov Shelzeh. The head of body one was next to the feet of body two. The Roisha Shelzeh and the head of body two, Betzad Margloisov Shelzeh, were next to the feet of body one. There might have been a third body that was buried parallel to one of those bodies in a normal way. Nevertheless, this isn't a normal way of burial, and therefore ein lohem tfusa velo shchunas kvoros. You're going to be able to move them without having to worry about moving the surrounding dirt, nor will the three bodies buried in this fashion constitute a shchunas kvoros. Motza shlosha. You found three bodies. Ha'echad yodua ushnayim tchila. O echad tchila ushnayim yeduim. You found three bodies, but they weren't all three just chanced upon. One of them was known to have been buried there. Two, you in fact chanced upon, or the other way around. Ein lohem tfusa, ve'ein lohem shchunas kvoros. So the rules of taking the surrounding dirt with them don't apply, and we are not going to establish a shchunas kvoros in a case like that. The Tosfos comments on this. He has two approaches. Let's take a look at the Tosfos together. The end of the narrow lines. Echad yedua shnayim hu moitzei ato betchila. One was known from beforehand as being buried there, and two you just chanced upon. Ein lo shchunas kvoros. Rashbam pirish. The Rashbam approach to this is halacha lemoshe misinaihu. It's an oral tradition. It's not necessarily based on logic. It's a given. The re pirish tam b'dover. The re says there is logic behind this. The ein lonu lomar shchunas kvoros ubeisa kvoros hoya. It's not likely that this was a formal cemetery. Hayol v'niklu sham shloisha mesim. Just because three were buried there, came on to echad noda tchila. Since one, and I might emphasize, only one of them was known from beforehand, one or two known from beforehand. Esau, the ein daito hoya lefanosam, for the shoyer sham bekivram. If it were so that all three were buried there deliberately to remain there and not be moved, ki hechi diodua lanu echad, you doim lanu oisam shimo. Just like one was known, so the other two would have been known as well. V'lo amru shchunas kvoros, ela o l'shloshi yeduim, o l'shloshi tchila. The rule of shchunas kvoros is stated only if you have three that were known to be buried there, and then you certainly could not move them. And according to what Tosfos implies, you'd have to also search the 20 amas in their vicinity. Or if you found three bodies for the first time. We continue in the Gemara. Ma'aseh Rabbi Yeshevov, Shebodak u'motzo shnayim yeduim ve'echad tchila. was an incident where Rabbi Yeshevov was checking out. He found two previously known bodies to have been buried there, and one no one knew about. He chanced upon the third body for the first time. Ubikish la'asos shunas kvoros, and Rabbi Yeshevov wanted to declare this a shunas kvoros. They are to remain there with all the laws we mentioned above. Omar lo Rabbi Kiva. Rabbi Kiva responds and says, "Kol shiogata, all of your efforts lo rik yogata, they were for naught. Lo omru shunas kvoros elo shloisha tchila." The Gra takes out the phrase that we actually saw in the Tosfos. So, leaving it as the Gra reads it, the din of Shunas Kvoros is stated only with regard to three bodies that you happen to chance upon. As opposed to what happened with Rabbi Yeshevov, that he didn't chance upon for the first time all three. He chanced upon one, the other two having been known from beforehand as having been buried there deliberately. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.